Hello, Timothy. This is Scott calling from 4ZZZ in Brisbane. How are you?
I'm about 76 kilograms. How are you?
Oh, excellent, excellent. So what are you up to today?
What am I up to? I'm working on edits of a book and just grateful to actually be at home for a day. So, in between editing, unpacking suitcases and restringing guitars
What's this book?
Oh, it's a book I've got coming out in late August. It's a memoir of sorts, but it's not chronological, and very little about the band. I've just been asked by a publisher to attempt writing something memoirish, and I have. It's worked out quite well, actually, very well.
Well, that's very exciting. Have you kept a lot of diaries over the years?
No, it's not like that. It's more from the perspective of a 47-year-old D-list celebrity, and as I say, it's not about chronologies and necessarily touring experiences, but more a perspective
Right.
about everything apart from playing a rock band.
Have there been any other non-chronological memoirs that you've taken influence from in writing this book?
Oh yeah. I think David Sedaris, of course, is a huge joy of mine. David Rakoff as well. I think Jeff Dyer, the English journalist as well, does these kind of memoir pieces very well. Don Walker's book I enjoyed very much. And I was attempting quite a few fictions in there, short fictions as well, but they've been kept for possibly something else. They didn't fit as well as we liked with the non-fiction pieces.
So there could be a short story collection as well in the future.
Well, I admire the art so much. I think that my lack of training is becoming a problem. I didn't think it necessarily would be, but it is, and I respect those who have really worked hard at art, and I'm just beginning. And life experience can only count for so much, because I'd like to stand among writers I admire and feel that I've done the work. So I'm prepared to work at it, though, once I get over writing this one.
Well, that's something to look forward to, definitely.
Well, it's daunting because I love the process and I also detest it. But it's collaboration. It's far more collaboratory than I would have thought, and I'm enjoying that side of it, and also being really annoyed by it. Having three very, very intelligent women as my editors, they're wonderfully infuriating.
So, you started your tour for your new record in Adelaide. How was the first show?
Well, we did that show. I did that unlike the rest of the tour because we were playing an outdoor winery in Adelaide, and so we just pitched a little show in a pub the night before. And the show's coming up quiet, and that sort of thing doesn't really work in the venues I was being asked to play last week. So I took Davey and his band over, and we just chose to play full tilt. And for a lot of the shows coming up, I don't feel like doing that. So, in Brisbane, I'll have a collaborator of mine, Zanny Kolach, and then for a lot of the other shows, I'll have Cleo Renner, who's a pianist that I've been working with, and there'll be shows that are more lyric-based, and but the ones in Adelaide, we're just thumping people over the head, but we're going back there in 3 weeks and with Cleo and Zanny and yeah, delivering this different kind of show.
So tell me about this new album, An Act of Repairs.
Well, it's a work of genius. Well, it started off as an orchestral record because I got an offer from the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra to write with them and to play with them, and I was currently writing a small fiction on an actor appearing of no specific gender, but working in and around theatre and a bit of film over the past a decade in particular, actors fascinate and bewilder and disappointment. And I started writing fiction, started writing songs to accompany it because I can't help myself because I find writing songs a little more pleasurable than writing fictions. rather prose. And so, but then budgets and also my desire to orchestrate everything fell away, and myself and a few collaborators started producing the arrangements for the songs, and they work better and they suit the lyrics better. I was also going to get a lot of different singers, particularly women, because it fit with the script on the record. And again, when I talked to the singers in particular, I sort of shied away from that. I was glad I went through that kind of process and got a lot of good ideas from talking to the women I was going to be working with. But it's ended up like it is now, where it's half lightly orchestrated and half, it's not really folk music. I mean, the lyrics are kind of highlighted, but the music behind, we wanted to lay down instrumentation that was folk and then replace it with instruments that whatever we were hearing in the lyrics. Shane and Mara and I, this is an extraordinarily long answer, I do beg your pardon, but so if there would be pedal steel on something, then we'd replace it with, because pedal steel didn't necessarily evoke the mood that we were looking for, so we'd bugger with it somehow. A lot of clarinet, there's a lot of percussion, double basses being played as if they were kitchen machinery.
And did you find that that was pushing you out of your comfort zone in terms of recording?
No, because the musicians I work with, although they're more dexterous and more skilled than I am on their instruments, I only work with people that I knew this time, and knowing musicians from a lot of different fields that I've been lucky enough to be playing with. Some through working with the Bamboos, and others through working with orchestras, and others through Uli and David played on a lot of the tracks, but not a lot of guitar. I could talk in emotive language rather than the vocabulary of a trained musician. I like that. And I think to people, it can be annoying for people, for real musicians, but every one that I worked with on this record, I was kind of relieved because I could talk in impressionistic ways and they understood it. Ebony and Ivory living together in perfect harmony, you know.
So what is it about the character of the actor that you think we... Because as a society, we do find actors interesting. What is it about them that makes them so curious?
Well, I find them interesting and dreadfully dull in equal measure, because I've got to qualify that, and particularly because I have some very close people, very dear and close to me, who are professional actors. And it's a curious art. Because this is someone leaving the stage rather than someone pursuing a life on the stage, it's someone looking back and wondering if they've approached personal relationships to foster their art and not been a dreadfully good person, really.
And is there something to it, like a lot of artists might have that, because they could probably approach their art wholeheartedly to the sacrifice of other aspects of their personal lives. But actors in particular, because they're pretending to be other people, and was there an element of looking back and realizing maybe you've lost your life to being someone who wasn't even there?
Oh, of course. Yeah, of course. It sort of was born out of a conversation I had with an actor who's a little older than me, and we're just drinking partners, and just sensing that. But I wouldn't be so as condescending as to say I'd understood the life that they've led, but it's an odd one, and because of the very small experiences I've had with it. But it's what I wanted to be as a kid, absolutely, well before being a musician. And it's less ambivalent. And, you know, with songwriting, I kind of dot the I's and cross the T's for 80% of things and then leave this 20% unexplained even to myself, because I find that during the process of playing new songs that it'll be one night, it'll come to me, and either a character fleshes out or the idea fleshes out. And I'm glad I left a little bit underdone, much to the frustration of publishers.
So when you're acting, do you feel like you give 100%?
Oh, well, I'm a terrible actor, so that's... I don't give 100% at all, or even 80%. No, dreadful, dreadful actor. But being in the company of people who do act, they're... in the way that they're... affection can be very seductive, but they're sort of keeping in the back of my mind, maybe their affections, they're just studying me. They're not looking at me with a loving gaze. They're looking at me because they're studying me, looking at my emotional responses, and they're packing them away in their kit bag.
They're capturing a bit of your soul to use later.
No, no, they're never going to get my soul. They'll never take that. It's a very high energy profession. There's also the competitiveness of it, which I've experienced possibly counteracting. As I said, a number of young actors I was working with last year and the rest of their lives is filled with altruistic pursuits because I think they are concerned about the self-centeredness that you can fall into. Not as bad as being a musician, but, and so the rest of the life is dedicated to doing things for other people and generally, you know, with their hands and lives. And I've been noticing that more and more. I mean, I think my attitude towards a lot of things is probably born from impressions I had as a kid and watching and being involved in things from decades ago.
Well, you've done a fair bit of work in the worlds of theatre and film in the last few years. What place does the three-minute pop song still have in your heart?
Well, it's far more important to me than anything else in as far as arts goes. I don't do things because I get asked to do them. I don't pursue them. I'm ecstatic to still be able to do it. I think it's got an immense value because, as with fiction, it's not the dominant art form in contemporary culture, but for those who can tune into it, it can plead for empathy, and I think it can afford people the opportunity for empathy. And if people take the patience to even give a three-minute pop song a listen, I do prefer songs that don't have banal lyrics, but having said that, of Limit or Van Buren makes more sense to me than a lot. So I'm consistently wondering why three-minute pop songs, three-minute hardcore punk songs, three-minute jazz explorations move me so much. I'm sort of tempted, you know, I read quite a bit of Oliver Sacks, but until he starts talking about music, because I never want to understand what it does to people, to myself neurologically. It's a great mystery to me and always will be. My daughter sent me a 2.5-minute song that she sent from New York just yesterday, and it's destroyed me. It was so wonderful, and it's chords and words and words and music. And
was this a song she wrote or one she found?
No, one she wrote. She's 16 and she's an excellent violinist, but she wrote a song as a project for school, but she sent it to me. It was gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous, and really eccentric chord changes and beautiful sort of swooping melodies. But even though it was for a school project, I could see, you know, it wasn't entirely fiction.
So you're appearing at the Rock and Roll Writers Festival here in Brisbane. What panels are you going to be on?
Well, I really lucked out. I didn't realise what it was all about, and these were panels and discussions when I said yes. The Leander Souza, who runs the festival, contacted me, and I just liked her verve and what she was trying to do, but I didn't really understand it. And then I got sent a couple of weeks ago on a panel with a couple of gentlemen talking about, what she just asked, really, that, you know, that where does the 3-minute song have in contemporary culture, and is it offering any real solace or any real help, or does it offer any direction in, you know, this sort of extraordinarily odd, depressing state of things at the moment? And then another panel on masculinity and sexuality in music, which I'm doing with Adelita and writer Holly George Warren, who's written a couple of my favourite books on music, and I just spoke to her recently, so I'm excited to be doing that. And which is interesting because I think, you know, masculinity and sexuality, you know, I sort of enjoy music, and I was grateful to be a part of it because growing up involved in a lot of very masculine and macho blokes kind of world, it was a world, I guess, that more from, you know, whatever you want to call it, indie rock or whatever, where it was completely divorced from that. First manager was a woman, that first band I was in, the feminine presence was the dominant one, and all that masculine macho bullshit was picked out of there. But anyway, that's what I'm doing, and then doing a show that night.
So I guess you were, as you say, fortunate enough not to go through a particularly macho kind of musical career, but do you think the scene overall, in terms of masculinity and femininity, has changed a lot since you started?
Yeah, it seems to be, to me, I run into more women, more young women, older women, who are, happy is the wrong word, but doing such wonderful and important stuff. And yet, I keep running into these situations where men are being cockheads and the two just tend to clash, at festivals, and which I don't go to, but play them sometimes in this real, come on, blokey.
Toxicity,
did you say?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm really, you know, the time I felt it the most was when I'm sharing a hotel. It was with the Bamboos, and there was a dance music festival, Future Music Festival, going on across the road, and I'd never been in the middle of such aggro, macho toxicity in my life, I think. And, I play footy and cricket and them all, and I've just never seen such absolute bullshit in my life. It was an odd and beautiful electronic dance music, which I thought would provoke a bit of gender equality or be bereft of that bullshit. But, yeah, there it was right in the middle of it. Anyway.
I think they're just taking the wrong drugs for that music these days.
Yeah, I think so too. But look, not being in there, of course, that's from the perspective of a 47-year-old who's been playing in a rock band since he was 16, so I'm not sure whether I'm the most informed. So I'm looking forward to listening at the panel very much, very much. I find I learn more the less I say.
Well, lastly, Tim, I wanted to ask, where do you find magic in life these days?
What a wonderful question. I do find it in music, but I'm thankful enough to have access to it, because I live with a lot of fear. But the release from fear somehow cracks open my heart and my mind, and I've got sort of access to what I believe would be magic, which of course are the throes and the whoops and walls of the heart and mind. Being separated from the person I love most in the world, I have to believe in magic, because I'm sending things to her every night and every day, and accessing that's easy. And I'd like to, because I do have that opportunity to share optimism with people at the very least, and wonder and expectation, particularly as I'm getting older, and the temptation is always to close up and become more cynical, and I don't think I've ever been sort of uncynical.
How do you manage that as a father in the year 2017 with everything going on? How do you keep that optimism?
I have to. I encourage anybody to, when they feel that losing that, to stop looking at your telephone and your computer. And we've got this access to nature, and we've got this access to art and to literature, and it's an incredible leviate for the soul and for your mind to get involved in that. And so that's, if I stand for anything, it's that, but we've got this incredible opportunity to access things in the natural world and in the artistic world, and we should involve ourselves in that, but most importantly, to share it.
Tim, thank you very much for talking to us today.
You're a wonderful interviewer. It's a pleasure to talk to you. Bye-bye.